is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. Today, I want to speak about adventurers, and I want to speak about empathy. Because with the inspired, so often the two go hand in hand. There are those who carve out a bold destiny with the lamp of empathy leading the way. I feel that is true with my guest today. Pianist Laura Downs is a trailblazer of discovery. NBC News refers to her as a musical ray of hope. Journalist Andrew Eisenstein refers to her as the queen of classical music in California. In fact, her list of accomplishments, her performances, and collaborative ideas and projects is so long that I am almost overwhelmed. I have interviewed many celebrities, but Laura Downs' work is simply blowing my mind because she is an explorer of music in every form. After an extraordinary upbringing, being homeschooled, her family traveled extensively. She spent time in Europe studying at schools such as the Mozarteum in Salzburg, giving her a broader spectrum of the musical world palette. She has studied with teachers such as the legendary Austrian pianist Adolf Baller, and has performed in venues around the world, exploring cultures, genres, and undiscovered music in America's multicultural history. Out of her dozens of recordings, she has collaborated with artists such as Yo-Yo Ma, Broadway legend Brian Stokes Mitchell, and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Rita Dove. Laura now releases This Land, a recorded project that is devoted to our pivotal time in American history, and which includes her recording of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue Reimagined with the high-octane arrangement by composer Edmar Colon. You can hear Laura in her popular NPR music series, Amplify with Laura Downs, now in its fourth season with hundreds of thousands of devoted fans. Her fierce devotion to advocacy has led to her role as an artist ambassador for Headcount, a nonpartisan organization that uses the power of music as a means to register voters and promote democracy. Well, Laura Downs, welcome to Center Stage. It is such a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you. And that was the best introduction I've ever had.
Oh, that's so good. I love to hear that. I do try to find the heart of an artist by just peering into their lives as much as I can. And your life just seems to be enshrouded in this word empathy. Am I close to that?
I mean, I think you really are. It's funny. You know, that's not how I normally think of it, but you're exactly right. And that is kind of the driving force.
You seem to have an empathy for what the world needs. And you also have a desire to really program very interesting projects. I mean, this seems to be your calling card, Laura.
Yeah, I think it's actually my calling. You know, I think it's finding a reason in all of this. You know, it's finding the meaning and the intention and the potential and the connection. It's all of those things.
Wow. When did you first come to music?
Oh, well, I have always said I started, you know, playing lessons at four. But then I recently, my mom passed away in December, and I was going through all of her things, and I found this picture of myself at the piano, and I'm not two yet. I'm not saying that I'm playing, but I'm sitting at the piano with such an intent, absorbed look. It's very strange. So, you know, I think my memories at the piano, my existence at the piano predates my memories at the piano.
How you were one of those that just crawled out of the womb and was prepared to take on the musical world. Oh, I get it. I can remember climbing onto a piano bench and trying to play a Beethoven sonata when I was about three. So I get it. Listen, I believe in the power of origins. And, you know, I know for myself, I grew up in a small town in Eastern Oregon, and I had to really fight to find my musical chops. For you, You had a really extraordinary upbringing. You were born into this family, a white Jewish mother and a Jamaican American father. I mean, this really set about this interesting panoply of a broad spectrum for you to be educated within.
Yeah, you know, as you can imagine, my parents met really in the context of the civil rights movement. And so I think when they partnered and they decided to start a family, it really came with a lot of vision about the future of America. And we were the test cases, my sisters and I, you know. And I'm so grateful in retrospect. I mean, one of the things you mentioned, the homeschooling, and that was really about letting children be themselves, learn what they wanted to know, be curious. You know, just grow. And it was rocky, but that intention was really important. And the further along I go in my life, I realize it all starts at the beginning. And whatever is nurtured and, you know, starts to bloom, that's what's going to carry you.
And I gather that your mom really set out to introduce music to you and your sisters. In fact, I think there were three pianos in your home.
Three pianos. Yeah. My mom was funny. Yeah. I mean, there were three of us, and so there were three pianos. I mean, a lot of the day was spent, I'm not gonna, not just with music, but with the arts, you know. When I think back, I think math was a little bit neglected, but there was ballet and there was piano and there was children's chorus. And being in the children's chorus at the opera and going to things, she took us to everything. She took the three of us. She would take us all the time to the San Francisco Opera and the ballet, you know. And I have these memories of the three of us in our little, you know, velvet coats. And she would buy standing room tickets. And there was this usher named Miss Beverly. And she would always look for us and she would find seats, empty seats. And she would come and whisk us and put us in the seats. And I mean, really just a steady diet of, you know, the live arts, which was foundational.
That is so tremendous. I mean, to everyone listening, let this be a lesson because it just paves the future for creativity. And I gather that you lost your father early on when you were quite young, and your mother set out with you and your sisters across Europe. And that must have had an extraordinary effect on you musically.
So much, you know. I think we had, you know, we were odd little kids, right? Sort of that prodigy thing. Not that my mom didn't push that, but that was the center of our lives, all this music and being homeschooled. So I never felt like a typical California kid. And it really wasn't until we landed in Europe where the culture, the tradition of this music was so much more embedded that I felt sort of like a normal person who belonged, you know, and then I just like soaked up that sense of history, that sense of tradition and 6 degrees of separation, and your teacher studied with this teacher who studied eventually with Brahms, right? You know, that thing.
I know that thing. That's a marvelous thing. So, when was that moment when you knew that music was going to be your life? Was there a catalyst? Was there one of those aha moments for you?
I think I always knew that music was my life somehow. It was my language and it was the place where I felt able to express myself. There were a couple of little moments when I thought at one point I wanted to be an actor and at one point I wanted to be an archaeologist, but I was a child. But I always loved the instrument and the music. But what happened was a moment when I questioned why I wanted to be a musician.
Oh,
Not that I
interesting.
wanted to be one, but why I wanted to be one. And that was really important. It was painful. It, you know, took some transformation, but all the time now when I'm mentoring young musicians, I talk to them about the why, because you have to know why. Otherwise, this is a very, very long, very straight path. And
Very
sometimes it
interesting.
goes into a brick wall, you know?
Wow. So this is important because I know so many classical musicians who never ask the why. They're just on that kind of focus of practice, practice, never get out of the Juilliard practice rooms. And when you asked yourself why, what was your answer?
Well, it was really, so I think I started to feel that I was on that, you know, highway to nowhere at a certain point. And I remember having this feeling when I was in the conservatory, you know, as a pianist, my God, there's so many of you, right? And I remember sitting in the practice room and practicing my Chopin etude and hearing the same etude circulating through all the practice rooms. And it just felt insane. It felt like we were all doing the same thing for the same reason. And then only comparing ourselves to each other, it just didn't feel like there was any purpose to that. I think the purpose for me actually came when I moved back to the States, and I was very young, and I sort of ran away from home and came back here with a boy, and everybody was really mad about it. But I got here and realized that I really didn't know what it was for me to be an American, because I'd been gone, you know, I'd kind of grown up overseas.
Okay.
I certainly didn't know what it was to be an American artist. And then I realized, well, what is an artist really? Because when you've done your training in Europe and then you come back here and, you know, the hustle and the grind, it's dramatically different. And I was all in, but that's the moment when you ask yourself, you know, this is hard. Do you want to do it? And if you want to do it, then why? And I realized no one had ever given me any why. It was just, you're so talented. Here's your homework, you know, very good. Here's more. No one talks about the why.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're bringing up a very important point. This is a lifetime of dedication and discipline. And I feel in your case, you were given particular gifts, maybe from your parents, maybe just popping out of the womb, of being a kind of inventor, a producer. You strike me as a natural programmer with a very innovative process. And perhaps that was at the base of the why. I mean, you know, you had a lot to say, and perhaps the traditional route just wasn't that way.
Yeah, no, I knew it didn't feel good. It didn't feel rewarding. It didn't feel useful. You know, I think that one of the big problems, and maybe what was so shocking to me when I came back to the States, is that I had this feeling that the arts, classical music, it's not particularly valued here. You know, my ex was a scientist, and we were hanging out with his friends in academia, and they all had their plans about what they were going to do for the world. And I felt like they were treating me like I was doing something fancy and, you know, a little frivolous. I mean, they respected it, but it didn't feel like it was like there was any parity. And I knew somehow that music can be really important. And having come across people like Yo-Yo, you know, when I was young, or Tom Hampson was somebody who I saw, you know, he was at the height of his young career when I first saw him on stage in Vienna, Barber of Seville. And I remember when I came back here and I started being curious about American music, and I stumbled across all of Tom's work with, you know, Song of America and Library of Congress. And I thought, oh, this guy who's tall and handsome and dashing, you know, and an opera star, is also a scholar, and he's learning stuff and he's teaching stuff and he's expanding people's minds. Oh, I can do that.
That is super cool. I love that. You know, just as a matter of course, Tom Hampson comes from where I am at right now in Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington.
Right.
He's actually
Spokane,
from the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
You know,
we did a show together in Spokane. All his family came. It was really fun.
That's fantastic. Oh, I love what he's done for the world of music, especially in the area of song, of course.
Yeah.
You know, he set out with a voice that he wanted things to be remembered. He wanted forgotten pieces of music to really be focused upon. But you have done the same thing. You have gone to forgotten composers. You have gone to forgotten composers in the African-American world and genre. And I think this is outstanding of you to have highlighted. How did you come to that course?
So when I came back here, you know, this sort of crisis of identity also included, it included gender and it included race in the world of classical music. You know, is all of the music created by dead white men with big bushy beards? It was a big question for me. Until that time, that's what I believed to be true.
Yeah.
And so I started digging around and, you know, fairly quickly found some things that they're out there. The information's out there, but none of my teachers had ever shared that with me. So, you know, William Grant Still, the Dean of African American Composers, and I listened to the music. Oh, my goodness, what is this sound? You know, this is beautiful and this sounds so American. And now I'm starting to understand that this echoes me too. So I came across in a library, in an actual paper book, this compilation called 100 Years of Piano Music by Black Women Composers. Not a super catchy title. And it was not a very thick book. and it was 100 years of music. Mm-hmm. But that was my introduction to Florence Price. And there's a piece by Margaret Bonds in there that I still play very, very frequently now. And, you know, that just opened up a world of curiosity, not only about the music, but then if I didn't know that about the music, then what else didn't I know about American history and American culture? And, you know, that's what I've been doing ever since, is just trying to find out more and more and more. And it's so funny because it's not really until, you know, these last few years that I think that our nation as a whole is on this mission as well, to sort of clarify the truth of our history and uncover these buried stories.
I absolutely
and so my work
agree.
Yeah, hitting it.
I absolutely agree. Wow. You see, you are a pathfinder. Love adventurers. You know, I've had so many people on my show who I've called adventurers. And here you are, this deep explorer. And I find this so fascinating that you've carved your own niche. And it seems to me, and especially hearing you now and getting to know you, that you haven't looked back. You know, you haven't looked back to that traditional Chopin etude and worried about it. Whereas so many performers who are schooled really do worry about it and how they're perceived. You've really had your own original voice, Laura.
Yeah, no, I haven't looked back. I think there was a moment after I started down this path where I looked at my colleagues who were doing the traditional thing, you know, and they were traveling around and playing concertos with orchestras, and it looked so, it looked like there was a structure there. And it was hard doing what I was doing. And there was a lot of convincing people and a lot of, you know, being really persuasive and somehow really believing in what I was doing, which I think is good for a young person. But it certainly was not easy at the beginning.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And I don't know why. I really don't know why I try to understand it, because I don't know what it was in me that just felt that this was the right thing.
Mm-hmm. No, you followed your path. You followed your bliss, as Joseph Campbell would say. I mean, you've got it right. Your intuition speaks loudly. I love this. Yeah. Do you feel that then that classical music is starting to shift a little bit? That perhaps that there is, I hate the word crossover, but I have to use it because I feel personally that there is a blending of styles going on in classical music and certainly in opera right now. Do you have any opinion about that?
Oh, yeah, it's everything's changing. And I do think it's, these things are all connected and organic. I think that actually the recovery of all this music really from the 1930s, that time when, you know, music for the people and when jazz and classical were colliding and connecting and commingling. And then that got cut off, that got cut short in the 1940s and 50s. And we kind of didn't go back until so recently. But I think that the young composers who are writing today really subscribe to the Duke Ellington quote, you know, there's two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. And there aren't any boundaries. You know, it's not just what they're writing, but it's why they're writing. They're writing for film and they're writing for the concert stage and they're writing for the opera house and they're writing for the clubs. And it's awesome. It's so good. It's like the music is breathing and it's reaching all kinds of different audiences and it's bringing different kinds of people together in the same rooms. And I mean, I'm so grateful to be living this moment. It's really beautiful.
I'm so grateful that you're brave enough to go out there and develop your own voice within all this, because you're right. That Duke Ellington quote means everything. It means absolutely it means everything. And it's interesting how now we're seeing opera with African Americans as composers. They're bringing up so many important issues. We're not afraid to look anymore.
Yeah, right, right. It's going to be a healthier next generation for sure.
I think so. I think so too. Mm-hmm. So here you are having this dandy life. I mean, you're popular, you've got all these recordings, you're mixing with everybody in the entertainment world, it seems. It's fantastic, right?
It's
How do you
so
find
fun.
Time? How do you find time for your family and your husband and normal life in California?
Yeah. I mean, I don't sleep that much. And,
really?
You know, I do work a lot. I just come back. I took a whole week off and we were in the Galapagos, which was a gift for my husband because he's an evolutionary biologist and he'd never been to, you know, Darwin's stomping grounds. But I don't know. I think I'm very good at doing five things at once. That is perplexing to him. Like, I don't understand what you're doing right now. I'm just juggling. But yeah, that's how I thrive. The only part of my life that I don't love is all the hours on all the airplanes.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Are your kids grown up now?
They are. Yeah, they are.
Okay.
And
So,
they are,
you know, mom can have her time and she can get on the planes and get off and be the superstar.
No, there were a lot of years when I can't tell you how many red eye flights I took so I could shorten that time away, you know, and really tried to downplay anything that I was doing because I was always there, you know, I was always helping out in the classroom and you know, doing all the everything. And it worked out really well. I think they are both of my kids are intensely creative people. And it was funny. I was talking to one of them not long ago and I said, you know, it's so cool to watch you guys do this adulting thing. You're doing such a great job. And I don't mean that you're like, you know, paying your bills. I mean that I see you like taking in the world. And my son said, Mom, what are you talking about? He said, our whole lives, we've just watched you like figure out what you wanted to do and do it. So that's what we do too. And I thought, oh, I guess, you know, they were just watching. They were just watching.
You're a strong voice. You're a really strong voice. I love that. Isn't that beautiful to see displayed for you?
Yeah, it's the best. It's the best.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Hey, talk to me about your love of Scott Joplin. Because you were introduced to him along the way. I think he went to see The Sting and you kind of fell in love with the music. What happened within you when you heard Scott Joplin?
Well, you know, those were really early days. I was, 7, 8 years old. And again, you know, those beginning lessons, I was playing a lot of Bach and Mozart and, you know, some Beethoven and Bartok and things like that. And I loved it. But there certainly wasn't any door open between the core classical repertoire and anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when we went to, my mom took us to see that movie, it was like in a, what do you call, not reruns, but, you know, it was in a revival in at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. And yeah, just the sound of it, something, I don't know, something just got awakened. And I asked my teacher for permission to play The Entertainer, like every other child in America. And then I didn't really think much more about Joplin, honestly. I really didn't until I found myself immersed in this investigation of the music of these Black composers. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Does Joplin, you know, where does he sit in this whole lineage?
Yeah.
And, you know, then you learn more about Joplin and you're like, oh, he was right there. And he was just 10 years too early to do what he wanted to do.
Interesting, isn't it? Wow. Wow. Very, very interesting. You've had such an amazing existence. And here you are, is NPR show. Yeah. Amplify. Mm-hmm. Amplify with Laura Downs. Did you choose that name?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. Because this all happened. The NPR show got started really just during the pandemic. In March of 2020, when everything, you know, came to a...
Oh, yeah, that fateful month.
Grinding halt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say that's the only time in my life that I have been actually depressed. So sad, so scared, so sort of frozen. And what I needed to do for my survival was to talk with my friends and colleagues, the people that I never usually see because we're all just chasing around the country and the world. But, you know, we were all home and I was having these conversations and it was just kind of checking in to see how everyone was. And at the same time, I had been meant to go to DC and film a Tiny Desk concert in April, which of course got canceled as well. And so I was in touch with the NPR team. And as that spring went along, and then in the wake of George Floyd's murder, you know, and this like quick shift in the industry, I was being asked like 6 times a day to be on all these panels about diversity in the arts and, you know, institutional change and this and that and hashtags. Remember all the hashtags?
Oh, yeah.
And it just felt necessary, but it also felt a little bit ineffective. And at the same time, I'm talking to my friends on the phone and, you know, we're having these conversations about our fear and our sadness, but also all of the realizations that we're coming to about our purpose, that why thing. That was what everyone was thinking about, you know, why do I do this? And maybe what has been wrong with it until now? And what do I want it to be? So I said to the team at NPR, you know, I'm having these conversations. It might be really interesting to kind of grab them. So we started filming these like you and I are doing right now on Zoom. And I think the technology was not very good yet. And
right.
But they were great conversations. And they sort of, you know, drew an audience quickly. And I can't tell you how much I love doing that show.
Laura Downs has the heart and passion of an ambassador for her art. Her new recording entitled This Land will be featured in her upcoming performance September 26th at Joe's Pub in New York City. And it is an evening of surprises as several of her friends will join her on stage, including New York Times cultural commentator John McWhorter, as he and Laura reflect on the independent and innovative essence of American music. I carry on in part two of my conversation with Laura Downs next week on Center Stage. And I hope you will go to centerstagewithpamelacoon.com for more of my broadcasts on the arts. The music you have heard today is Laura playing Paul Simon's America, Fantasia Negre by Florence Price, and Rhapsody in Blue Reimagined, which will be discussed next week. To all my listeners, stay safe out there. This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is now down on Center Stage.